I'm going to have to interrupt this call. I understand we're going to go to a live picture in Los Angeles. Is that correct? Okay. This is Interstate 5, and this is courtesy of KCALR, one of our L.A. affiliates. Police believe that that O.J. Simpson is in that car.
To many, O.J. Simpson had it all. Wealth, success, and a mountain of fame. In the 1980s and early 90s, he had the world at his feet. But as the public learned of the former American football player's passing on Thursday evening, only one thing came to mind.
O.J. Simpson attended funeral services for his ex-wife, accompanied by their two children, 9-year-old daughter Sydney and 6-year-old son Justin.
Give yourself up, man. Just stop. Please stop.
O.J.'s fame turned to infamy following the vicious murders of his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ronald Goldman, and a subsequent trial that would captivate the imagination of a truly global audience.
I mean, there were witnesses who were getting book deals. There were witnesses who were getting offers to pose in Playboy.
His defense team, arriving again this morning, has become world famous now.
And you say on your oath that you have not addressed any black person as a in the past 10 years, Detective Furman.
That's what I'm saying, sir.
And just like that, the state's case fell apart.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Sarah Cadden, features journalist with the Irish Independent, to discuss the life and death of O.J. Simpson, and the trial so big it's forever changed how entertainment and news have been consumed ever since. Sarah, take us back 30 years to June of 1994, and the names Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. Why did they make worldwide headlines?
Well, they were both murdered on the night of June 12th, 1994. And really, they weren't names that, you know, people in Ireland were aware of. But when they were killed, the chief suspect in the murder almost immediately was Nicole Brown's ex-husband, O.J. Simpson, who also wasn't that well known over here, but was a huge star in the States.
Number 32 emerged from the dugout. The calls rang out, O.J., O.J.
The sports star who'd kind of then segued into a big advertising campaign for Hertz rental cars, and he'd been in films like The Towering Inferno, the Naked Gun movies.
Norbert!
Hiya, buddy! Hey! Doc says I should be on my bean and as good as new in a week.
And back on the force.
Norbert! That's wonderful!
Whoa! Oh, Frank, everyone should have a friend like you.
Not a huge name here, but huge in the States, particularly because he had become a football star starting off in the late 60s. And now there are huge names in American sports, black athletes. But then this wasn't really a very common thing for there to be a big American football star who was black. So he was a hero is fundamentally what he was.
Yeah, and that was part of his iconic status. American football at that time was still a very, very white sport. And he broke through as a Heisman Trophy winner, which is the big award for college player, and then went on big star in the NFL. As you say, minor roles in Hollywood, kind of the straight guy to Leslie Nielsen's funny guy, so well known in that regard. Nonetheless, these murders, they were savage.
They were extremely savage. I mean, the scene of the crime, the amount of blood everywhere, you might remember kind of photographs of steps that were blood soaked and so on. And the injuries that were inflicted on Nicole Brown Simpson.
With her head cocked substantially back. And the strength in that cut is enormous. And by that, I mean she is going to receive a single slice to the front of the throat that is going to be so deep, it is going to nick her spinal cord.
She was practically decapitated. That was the extent of the cut to her throat. And there was great kind of savagery and anger, really, was quite apparent in the injuries of both of them. Ron Goldman was found kind of in the fetal position on the ground, and he had also been stabbed to death. And it was a very brutal crime.
What was it about O.J. Simpson and the relationship with his ex-wife that led the police in his direction?
They were divorced, but he had a conviction from the late 80s of domestic abuse that he had not contested against Nicole Brown.
911 emergency.
Can you get someone over here now to 325 Gretna Green? He's back. Please.
Well, okay, what does he look like?
He's O.J. Simpson. You're going to hear him in a minute. He's about to come in again.
Okay, just stay on the line.
I don't want to stay on the line. He's going to beep.
Wait a minute.
The first suspect in any of those kind of situations, it's often the spouse or ex-spouse whom they go to first. But his behavior after the murders were discovered really aroused an awful lot of suspicion. He had gone overnight to Chicago the night of the murders, and he returned the next day. And in that time before he returned, police had been to his house. There was a trail of blood near the door of his home. His car had blood traces in it. There were suggestions that something wasn't quite right, and suggestions that connected his home to her home where the murders had happened.
Yeah, so we've no eyewitnesses here, but there is the connection is there in terms of the past history and what the police find. So the police go to talk to O.J. Simpson. Then what happens?
Well, 4 days after the murders, the police had wanted to speak to him, and, you know, it was also playing out to a great extent on television, which was significant from the get-go with this case. And what then happened was that OJ, you could say, went on the run from the police, but basically took part in what was kind of the slowest car chase in history down the highway in LA.
They're going to go right toward the Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, Brentwood areas, where OJ lives, and where the two people killed also live.
With his friend driving the car, he was on the telephone at the time to, as it turns out, Robert Kardashian, father of the Kardashians, who became one of his lawyers in the trial. And they were driving incredibly slowly with this like trail of police cars with sirens behind them, but nobody really going anywhere very fast.
He's on the off ramp now, coming up the off ramp at sunset.
And evidence of that was that there was time for like hundreds of people to turn out at the side of the highway, cheering him on.
It is an amazing sight. Along the right-hand shoulder, people have pulled over, many of them carrying signs reading things like "Save the Juice," "Go OJ." People are literally cheering him on as he travels northbound on the 405.
This really set the tone for an awful lot of what followed. This was an event.
It was box office. To say he went on the run is kind of a bit of a, as you say, an overstatement. It's gone down the freeway, which anybody who's ever watched TV from America, it's just massive. A trail going behind them. He's in the car on the phone and he has a gun. And it's just absolutely dramatic. There's helicopters all over the place. And this is going out on live. It's one of those first major live TV moments, isn't it? We'd kind of take this for granted nowadays. But back then, this was huge.
It really was. And kind of when you look back on it now, it nearly had, as you say, about them having a gun and being on the phone to his friend and all of that kind of stuff. It was something weirdly performative about it. And also, because they were driving so slowly, It also made a sort of farce of it and sort of diluted the seriousness of what had actually happened.
Now, ultimately, Mr. Simpson is captured. He is charged with these murders. And we have what becomes known as the the trial of the century. You mentioned Robert Kardashian, the first lawyer he's speaking to. He's a personal friend of O.J. Simpson. He's divorced from Chris at that stage. He's very familiar to the entire Kardashian family. At one point, O.J. is staying in their house. But Kardashian isn't a criminal trial murder lawyer. So we have the dream team, the greatest defense team in history put together. Who are they?
Well, Kardashian kind of had to come out of retirement almost to represent OJ. He had to like reinstate his license in order to come back. The team was led by Johnny Cochran, who wasn't the first lawyer that was on his team, but there was a group of them and there was a falling out very early on, and Cochran was drafted in and led trial. And he really is probably the key player in the whole story.
It occurred to me how they were going to come here and stand up here and tell you how O.J. Simpson was going to disguise himself and go over and kill his wife.
What Johnny Cochran did was he turned it from what the prosecution was trying, which was that this was a situation where there was domestic abuse that had spiraled into, you know, what they presented as, if I can't have her, nobody can situation, where she ended up dead. Cochran managed to turn it from that to pivot the attention away and turn the whole trial into an issue of race and racism.
Yeah, and the other big names on of it, Bob Shapiro, who's originally in full command, Alan Dershowitz, who's still to this day a really highly respected academic lawyer in the US. And it really does come down to strategy. So the prosecution have got a straightforward case here. There is evidence of Simpson being involved in these murders, not eyewitnesses, but other evidence available to them. He appears to have a motive, and that seems to be the straightforward track that they go down, where the defense puts the LAPD on trial. And what were the key issues that arose there that allowed them to do that?
Well, as you say, the prosecution did have evidence. I mean, they had DNA evidence, but we are talking about 30 years ago, and that was kind of called into dispute. They had a pair of bloodstained gloves that they said OJ had worn on the night. They had blood in OJ's car that was Ron Goldman's blood, not Nicole Brown's blood. OJ Simpson did not know Ron Goldman. Ron Goldman was just incredibly unlucky to have been there in Nicole Brown's house. He wasn't a friend of hers. He'd been a waiter in a restaurant she'd eaten in that night. So, you know, it would seem that the prosecution had a lot to go on. But the problem was there was a police officer called Mark Furman on the case who had been at the scene of the murder. And I think it has been said since that the police didn't make a great job of preserving the crime scene, that the handling of it hadn't been very careful. And one of the things levelled at Furman was that he was a racist, which he completely denied on the stand.
You say on your oath that you have not addressed any black person as a or spoken about black people as in the past 10 years, Detective Furman.
That's what I'm saying, sir.
But they later found kind of audio of him using the N-word, talking about positively about kind of police brutality. And you have to remember, this was only a couple of years after the Rodney King trial in Los Angeles. So that was still pretty fresh in people's minds. And discrediting Furman really was a huge part of the defense's case. Also, memorably, OJ trying on the gloves.
Just to be clear to people, back in those days, this didn't happen. We watched hours of live coverage from the courthouse of this case on live television in this part of the world as well. I remember it across that year. The glove was the crucial moment, I suppose, in terms of the drama of the case. What happened there?
Even if you go back to the fact that the Rodney King case had only happened a couple of years before, you know, that there had been video footage of the night of the assault on him by the LAPD officers. And rolling news had just really become a thing. The Menendez case, the murder case, had also been televised by Court TV ahead of the OJ case. And rolling news had to have something to put on the screen. I mean, it all trivializes the fact that two people were murdered. But, you know, it was full on, full tilt drama. And the trying on of the glove was really pivotal in the whole case. And OJ played it like he was in a Naked Gun film. I mean, there was a sense of the man was slightly smirking, slightly playing, you know, playing it up. And he tried on the gloves with great kind of, fuss of trying to get them onto his hands and they didn't fit and looking, you know, sort of shocked that he was finding himself in such a situation.
The day that will live in trial infamy.
That's people 77.
And the turning point, Simpson slowly slipping on the gloves found at the crime scene. Gloves prosecutors say belonged to OJ, which did not fit. And just like that, the state's case fell apart.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
The defense seizing on the moment, that slogan, and victory.
And it has been said since that gloves that had been wet would shrink again when they dried, or that he stopped taking his arthritis medication and that caused his hands to be more swollen when he tried the gloves. But it was really his kind of performance of trying them on. And then Johnny Cochran's repeated mantra of, if they don't fit, you have to acquit. He was an extraordinary showman, Cochran, in that, you know, he really tapped into that thing that has become a huge part of modern life now, where if it is said enough times, people start to lose the distinction between what is fact and what they're just being told they should believe.
Maybe I can demonstrate this graphically. I'm going to show you something. This is a knit cap. You've been seeing me for a year. If I put this knit cap on, who am I? I'm still Johnny Cochran with a knit cap. And if you look at O.J. Simpson over there, from two blocks away, it's still O.J. Simpson.
And if they don't fit, you have to acquit, played a big part in Simpson's ultimate acquittal.
All of this looks fascinating now, because we'd now look at it and go, but they had DNA evidence. The problem is that back in those days, DNA was new and there was a jury here and they didn't understand what exactly that meant. So nonetheless, you're looking at it going, but he's guilty. Ahead of the verdict, there is a view that there could be riots in LA if he is found guilty. So a lot is hanging off of this verdict. It seems like the entire criminal justice system is on trial. Great tension building up to the verdict. What happens?
The world, it seemed, held its breath.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of...
The jury took only 4 hours to acquit him, which wasn't expected at all. And they came back with a not guilty verdict. And in LA, the police force were out in great force, in expectation, as you say, of there being rioting. And instead, there was this incredibly celebratory mood that OJ had been acquitted, because it was the court of public opinion. This was something that everybody had an opinion on. It stirred up a lot of passionate debate about racism, that a black man couldn't get a fair trial. At the time, the police on horses, the horses were literally frightened by the jubilation of the crowds in LA.
He got off because it wasn't the way it is.
They burst out into tears. They screamed. They rejoiced as police in riot gear looked on without emotion. Many say the verdict was a message not only about Simpson's innocence, but about racism.
So O.J. Simpson walks free, set the juice loose, as the slogan at the time. And in his post-trial life, he does not go back to be a celebrity cameoing in movies or anything like that. What's his life like, and when do we next really hear from him quite prominently?
Well, 3 years after the murder trial, it was a civil case taken against him, and he was found liable for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, and was ordered to pay $25 million in punitive damages to both families and $8.5 million compensation to Ron Goldman's parents. And they have always said they never saw any of that money. He lived a life that was you know, partly sort of in disgrace, but he never seemed to lose his sense of self-importance, you could say. And he never stopped being a public figure. He wrote a book in 2007 called If I Did It. And the Goldman family obviously came out really passionately against that book, particularly as it included a chapter that, you know, hypothetically told the story of the night of the murder as if he had been there. And so it was very much that this was sort of seen as both a confession and a payday for OJ. And the publication of the book was stopped. And later, the rights to the book were actually granted to the Goldman family and published as with a new title, If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer. And the "if" was in much smaller font than the rest of the title. I don't know how much money that they made off that, but significantly, they had an online kind of petition against OJ publishing the book, which was don'tpayoj.com. And you can kind of see 60,000 people around the world signed the petition, which probably isn't an awful lot by kind of today's metrics, but it kind of shows how in the time between the murder and 2007, the publication of the, of that book, something could be an international story because of the internet in seconds, and that people could get on board with something all over the world all at the same time and immediately. And there is a big sense that the O.J. Simpson trial started that ball in motion.
Sarah, things take a real turn for the worse for O.J. Simpson. There is an extremely serious incident in Las Vegas.
Yeah, O.J. Was in Las Vegas for a social event. And, you know, he's kind of described as being in the company of kind of yes men and hangers-on at this point in his life, and a slightly pathetic kind of a figure. And he basically, with some friends, burst into the room of someone he knew and accused of stealing sports memorabilia from him.
OJ and his men walked in. One of the guys pushed him and put a gun to his head.
The audio recording from the encounter shows how intimidating it was. The voice is Simpson's.
Did you feel like you were being held captive in that room, that you couldn't leave?
Absolutely. There was a gun there.
He was potentially going to be jailed for up to 33 years for this. But the whole audio speaks of a massive fall from grace for someone who was a massive hero to millions of people.
So how long does he go to jail for, ultimately?
He went to jail for 9 years, which, you know, at that point in his life would have really been quite a long time. And when he gets out, he became, in recent years, kind of quite a big social media personality.
You know, my life, I've had ups and I've had downs, but all in all, I've been a fortunate guy. God has been good to me.
He seemed to run the kind of fantasy football kind of thing on X, and he did some NFL punditry, which might not sound huge to us, but I mean, this is something that's viewed by millions and millions of people. It's massive. But look, it always, always followed him around that he got away with murder.
So how did he himself pass away this week?
Well, there had been kind of rumors that he was ill for some time, and he had kind of said that he'd caught cancer, but he was doing okay and it was going to be all right.
Good morning, I'm Diane Macedo. We're coming on the air because we have breaking news. O.J. Simpson has died.
His children issued a statement saying that he had died at home in Las Vegas, surrounded by his children and his grandchildren. Since then, there was one report that friends had been invited to come and see him because he was very unwell, but all had been prevailed upon to sign an NDA before they could come and visit him.
And Sarah, one cultural spin-off from the entire saga. Tell us what happened to that obscure family known as the Kardashians.
All right, we're ready.
No. You're ready. Here.
The wind, you guys. Is this necessary?
Go change.
Awful. No, that is not cute.
Yeah, I'm going.
Actually, I need someone to make me.
I mean, you could really draw a direct line from Kardashian to Kardashian on this one, in that, you know, there was Robert Kardashian in the trial of the century on the TV every day, and now his daughters are probably the most well-known siblings in the world. Apparently, the day after O.J. Simpson's death, when it was announced, the socials of Khloe Kardashian were flooded with condolences from people on the back of the rumor that has been consistently denied by OJ and by Kris Jenner that OJ was in fact the father of Khloe Kardashian. And I suppose you see in reports of this that a lot of it was really sincere concern for her that she'd lost her true father. And within that, you can see the blurring between if you hear something often enough, you start believing that it's true.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
And my thanks to Sarah Cadden. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of The Indo Daily was produced by Ian Doyle, researched by Dave Hanratty and JJ Clark, with sound by Rory Bones. Archive clips from ABC News, Court TV, CNN, Fox News, Inside Edition, CBS Chicago, BBC News, KCAL, and the Associated Press. If you enjoy The Indo Daily, don't forget to follow the podcast and leave us a review.